Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of November 2017. Welcome to episode 30 of this podcast. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these brief chats, which should make this pretty much the books I read during November. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those, but those posts are not really spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists, and here there's a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. Now, as we do on this show, I categorize the books that I read. And first are the books I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books, which this month was the homework book. For episode 110 of the Quarterbin podcast, I read The Eternals, number 9, which is part of our celebration of Jack the King Kirby's 100th birthday. We did a Kirby-themed Short Box Showcase episode recently, and we will have more Kirby or Kirby-related books here on the Quarterbin over the next 6 or 8 months as well. Now, I am counting these next few books as podcast-adjacent, podcast-related, as I covered a Dial H issue of Adventure Comics a while back on the Quarterbin show. Between quarter boxes at World's Greatest Comics and the Akron Comic-Con, I've accumulated a handful more of these. Some I put in the Quarterbin database, and 2 I read last month. Adventure Comics 483 and 486 each contained a pair of 10 to 13 page stories starring the mighty Dial Bearers, Vicky Grant and Christopher King. I remember these stories from growing up as being fun and adventurous and, yes, occasionally goofy. But what I didn't remember was that Marv Wolfman actually laid into these stories a bit of continuing character arcs. In one story, Christopher's father is shot, and for the next few, he is recovering. And the relationship between Vicky and Chris goes through its own ups and downs. And each one of these has their own little drama going on. There's another kid in their class that Chris just does not like. And that adds tension and even a bit of the junior high version of a love triangle, maybe. I was not surprised by the action and fun of these stories, but I was surprised by that bit of serialized storytelling. Definitely a fun title to revisit. On to new comics that we read right off the shelves. All these are from DC. Here, as the Rebirth era draws to a close, they're going to remove the Rebirth branding off of their books, from what I understand. Although the continuities and storylines will continue. Green Lanterns 33 and 34. These issues bounce back and forth between a dramatic and dangerous outer space lantern job and Simon and Jess's dramatic and dangerous attempts to get jobs here on good old Earth. Tim Seeley is really picking up where Sam Humphries left off in terms of really digging into the psychologies of the characters. That is the differentiator between this title and so many others. And when a new writer is brought into a title, often we get a major change, a major shift. Maybe the new person wants to set their own course, stake a claim, this is my book now. Or maybe they're tasked with the directive to change the book up to improve flagging sales, a directive from editorial or something. But Seeley is doing this, that is taking over the book or writing this arc, as a logical continuation of what Humphreys started, and that's always the preferred way to see a creator transition happen. The Hellblazer 15 seems to wrap up the three-part Inspiration Game storyline. And again, Tim Seeley does a really nice job combining the darkness of Constantine with enough humor and nuttiness to actually give the dark more resonance. Basically, Constantine messes around with reality, fights the Justice League. No, really. And he actually gets in first licks. And then sets things aright. Including adding another woman to the list of people who will hate him forever. Trinity, 14. It's looking bad for the title characters, as Superman and Wonder Woman are possessed at various parts of the story. But the evil Trinity needs all three possessed at the same time to release the power of the Pandora Pits. And it's during the recitation of that last sentence that I really wish I had a pop filter on this microphone. Everyone assumes that Batman will be easy to control because of his lack of powers, but he's more slippery than Cersei expects. And what about John Constantine, who was brought in, supposedly, to counteract all the evil magic stuff? Yeah, he's a little indisposed during this issue. Wonder Woman, 33 and 34. Darkseid's daughter Grail is continuing to find old gods to kill, to drain their power so that her father, Darkseid, can feed. He needs to do that because he was recently reincarnated as a baby during the events of Dark Knight Metal. As we start here, he's about 12 years old, maybe. Grail finds another child of Zeus, Jason, just as Wonder Woman finds this man, her half-brother. And the three-way fight doesn't actually shake out the way Wonder Woman expected. I have to mention a couple of specifics about these issues. I read them together, so the fact that Wonder Woman did not appear at all in issue 33 didn't bother me, but if I had read it as soon as I'd gotten it and had to wait for the next issue to actually run into the title character, I may have wondered where she was. And as far as issue 34 goes, DC noted on the cover that this was Wonder Woman's 700th issue. But I appreciated the fact that they didn't feel the need to renumber to get that. Yeah. I'm looking at you, Marvel Legacy. And courtesy of Iowa's Joe Crawford, I was able to jump a little bit into DC's big storyline by reading the book he sent me, Dark Knight Metal number 3. And like I've said before, this story has crossed over into a few titles that I'm reading. So I knew broadly what was going on, that Nth Metal was infecting the world, turning a lot of heroes evil, etc. So this is the middle of a story, but it was certainly dramatic and exciting. Not a bad read at all. I also read the storyline The Button from Batman 21 and 22 and Flash 21 and 22. This picks up the mystery from the original Rebirth special, where the bloody Watchman Button appeared in the Batcave shortly after Wally reappeared in the Rebirth universe. This does not answer every question, but it continues to ask the key one. What happened in the DCU the last few decades to make things go sideways? And why do some characters have memories that they shouldn't have? In this one, Eobard Thawne and Flash run through dimension after dimension, Batman in tow, trying to make sense of things. Thawne thinks he has the answer, but when he comes face to face with the source, his body disapparates right there in front of them all. So it's a quick story. It did push the overall arc forward, so it was an interesting read, and I am kind of glad they're taking this slow, and I hope when all is said and done, it makes at least the minimal amount of sense. And on to the general comic reading that I did. I spent some quality time at the Akron Comic-Con in early November, and I saw quarter bins! And I bought myself a bunch of comics. including Planetary Brigade 1 and 2 from Giffen and DeMatteis from Boom from 2006. I wasn't familiar with the title, but Giffen and DeMatteis superfan The Remedial Shag explained that this is related to their Hero Squared property, which I also wasn't familiar with, but he said that they were fun. And despite his reputation, Shag was correct on this one. It was a fun little series, taking on the tropes of a JLI-style team, with characters like the Third Eye, the Purring Pussycat, Captain Valor, and Earth Goddess. Not bad, and this is dangerous. But I will take Shag's advice, and will pick up any issues of Hero Squared that I can find for cheap. And as soon as I walked into the con, before I'd even found where P. Craig Russell or Tom DeFalco or any of the people I was looking for signatures from, I saw a local guy who was selling mini comics at the magic price of 25 cents. So I bought Cosine Cadets 1 through 5 at the even more discounted price of 5 for a dollar. And basically, these are for use in school classrooms, as each one is based around a math problem that our team of sci-fi math heroes is tasked to solve. They were actually written in a pretty fun manner. And from the quarter bins, World's Greatest Comics, I picked up Forgotten Realms, number one, the TSR tie-in book from DC from 1989. I like fantasy novels a lot, and fantasy TV is often good, but fantasy comics that I like are a little fewer and farther between, I think. And this one fell into the not as good category. I mean, every genre has its tropes, and it's those tropes that make the genre. Murder mysteries actually need to have a dead body. Noir needs a femme fatale. And fantasy has its tropes. But at this point in my life, maybe what I'm looking for in fantasy is originality, something different. And this one is just so stuck in fantasy gaming that I couldn't really enjoy it. So much D&D lingo, elves and bards and paladins. Of course, this is now almost 30 years old, so maybe it wouldn't have been as tired, as tropey back then. But reading it now, meh. My great buddy, Iowa's Joe Crawford, has sent nice care packages over the year, and from those I read Life with Archie Magazine, 15 and 24. This is where the Love Showdown storyline continues, split into the Archie Marries Betty and Archie Marries Veronica alternate timelines. These magazines included 20-plus pages of each different storyline, and we're looking at these characters about 10 years into the future, sort of late 20s, early 30s. We see the kids in marriages, and in a few cases in and out of marriages, or with a child on the way, battling cancer, moving on in their career, stuff like that. I like that for the most part, these futuristic versions of the characters seemed reasonable. These characterizations seemed believable in both timelines, actually, where these character lives go in different directions. Both seemed reasonable. Maybe a little sped up. Maybe it would take another 5 or 10 years to get some of these characters to know these points in their life, in their career. But that's really a minor quibble. And by the end of issue 24, there are indications that the universes may not be as separate and the boundary between them as inviolable as it may seem. So that's a really interesting idea. I don't know if we get a Crisis on Infinite Archies at some point, but it was really a well-executed idea as well. And I think to balance out these oversized magazines, Joe also sent Betty and Veronica Digest 204, another pretty good one with some solo Betty stories, solo Veronica stories, and of course, the two BFFs hanging out together, mostly causing trouble to the various males of Riverdale. Not in love with the Sabrina stories, Josie and the Pussycats, they added a lot to the collection. And Jughead and Friends Digest, 37, again, pretty good except for, no, not Lil Jinx, but two stories of That Wilkin Boy. Yikes. But there were a couple of solid stories set at Pops, one where Jughead learns an awful lesson about inflation. So it was educational and entertaining. I Was Joe also sent 100th Anniversary Avengers. In 2014, Marvel celebrated their 75th anniversary, and as part of that, they pulled out a handful of issues from 25 years in the future. So the joke on this one is that it was published, quote-unquote, in 2039. And joke is the right word because it most often goes for funny over everything else. And often, it hits the funny pretty good. Not a bad little one-shot at all. I read some other kids' books recently. From the quarter bins of World's Greatest Comics, I read Life with Archie 77. And from the great Cans and Gregor Rujo, I read Life with Archie 149. Between these two, we get Mr. Lodge adventures, the Archies playing music, Life on the Beach, and a rare two-parter, with Archie and Betty getting in over their heads, taking on water squatters, with Veronica coming to the rescue. I really like Life with Archie, as you get such a nice variety of stories, because it can feature any character, as long as they are interacting with Archie. Greg also sent another book published by Archie, The Adventures of Bayou Billy, number 4. I had no idea what to expect from this one, and now after the fact, I'm still not sure what I read. It was a pretty intense story of tragedy and revenge, but drawn very much in that classic Archie style. Very, very strange. I've mentioned a couple times recently in different episodes on the network that I've never really gotten into the character of the Hulk. And a few of you gently and kindly expressed your minor distress at this admission of mine. But I decided to give the character a shot. And so, again, direct from the discount bins at World's Greatest Comics, I read The Hulk Magazine, number 20 and 22 from 1980. These each contained a main Hulk story of about 40 pages or so, and the expanded page count, I think, did help. One story was about the Hulk versus a melting-down nuclear power plant, 3 Mile Island being only maybe 6 months beforehand, so you can understand the passion for the topic. But it's certainly not a balanced, well-thought-out take on the pros and cons of nuclear energy. But we'll get back to that topic in a second. Issue 22 had Bruce on a beach with a hot young research assistant trying to cure the Hulk. And that story involved an evil cabal of scientists in a base at the bottom of the ocean. And that's always pretty cool, to be honest. So lots of good stuff here, and it did soften my view of the Hulk a bit. But the highlight of these issues is located in the letter page of issue 22. Future top-notch comic scribe Kurt Busiek, at about age 20, really takes the magazine to task about the tone of issue 20, which I mentioned before. He did not like the anti-nuke bias. The letter closes with, "If you meant to be fair in your story, Doug," referring to Doug Mensch, "you failed." Ralph Macchio takes issue with this characterization and writes a response almost as long as Busiek's letter. And it's a really interesting back and forth. And of course, the fact that it's a future professional writer picking up on that issue, that concern, made it all the more interesting, obviously. The books sent in recently by the generous Canadian Rob Lance of the Comic Connection store in Oakville, Ontario, included Laugh, 223, 231, 234, 237, 312, and 316. These are fun because they have a nice variety of stories in them, again, not locked into a particular character or setting. So these can be about, you know, one of the Archie crew having an odd job, or them spending a day at the beach, a pool party at Veronica's, something at Riverdale High, the chocolate shop, and just wherever else the story needs to take place. Probably my favorite of these is the story starring Hot Dog, who had almost as bad luck with his love life that Jughead has with his, except that Hot Dog actually wants a girlfriend. And there's a really good one with Reggie, trying to make his nice new expensive car resemble Archie's old jalopy, assuming that that was his secret with the ladies. And that doesn't quite work for him. Chuck Clayton was the lead in a couple of these stories as well, and it was nice to see him featured. Now, I do have to warn you that issue 223 had both a Lil Jinx story and a That Wilkin Boy story. Again, Laugh 223. I'm just saying, you probably want to avoid that one. And Rob also sent Walt Disney's Mickey Mouse 98 and 108. These are from 1964 and 1966. The basic rule that I've discovered with Disney stories is that the longer the story is, the better the story is. Both of these feature one long story in the 15 to 18 page range, and each of those have epic sweeps. They're really globe-trotting adventures. In one, Mickey and Goofy head to South America to do some crop dusting, which I'll be honest, does not seem like a money-making venture. Can't believe that they would ever recoup their travel expenses. But that was a good story. But issue 108 had a great story. Mickey is a secret agent, and he's tasked to bring down an indestructible flying aircraft carrier and the evil leader behind the plot. What makes it work is that in addition to being a pretty good Mickey Mouse story, it's not a bad Cold War espionage thriller. Really enjoyable read. Thank you, Rob. Great variety, great choices. We're taking a break here, and when we come back, it's time for another installment of our Doomtastic new feature.
Hello, ladies. Listen to your man. Now listen to me. Now listen to your man. Now listen to me. Sadly, he isn't me. But if he stopped downloading lame-ass podcasts and switched to Two True Freaks, he could learn to sound like me. Look down. Back up. Where are you? You're on the Enterprise with a man your man could sound like. What's in your hand? Back at me. I have it. It's a long box filled with comics that you love. Look again. The comics are now episodes. Anything is possible when your man listens to Two True Freaks and not lame asses. I'm on a tauntaun.
And we're back with another installment of our new segment for the show, inspired by a comment made by Podcasting's Michael Bailey. So like we did last episode, we'll be analyzing a piece of comic narrative featuring Dr. Doom from, of course, Dr. Doom's perspective, or as we call it here, the truth, without what Big Comic would have you believe with their hashtag fake continuity. So let me welcome you back to Dr. Doom's Fireside Chat. And this episode, we're looking at an issue that was provided to me by longtime supporter of Relatively Geeky, the one and only Dr. Ange. He was at a Comic-Con earlier in the year and had the historian for this issue, Marv Wolfman, sign it to me. And of course, Ange picked this book because the Doomtastic one features so heavily in the story. So thanks, Ange. And let me say that the sovereign state of Latveria thanks you as well. If you ever need help with a parking ticket anywhere in Latveria, just give me a call and I guarantee that I could get that prison sentence reduced a little bit out of respect for your service to Doom. As far as that book that Ange sent to me, in the greater Latverian community, we refer to this title as Cancelled Comics Cavalcade. But I know it has a different name elsewhere. So, just by actually looking at the cover of this comic, I believe the issue would be indexed as To Professor Allen, Phantasmarvtik Wolfman 4, issue 199. On the cover, by Keith Pollard and Joe Sinnott, we have Doom in all his power-blasting glory, battling a weird-looking dude who sort of has flame powers and in a few places looks kind of like a certain ugly rock monster. To rule the world, Doom says calmly and rationally, I must slay my son. Them's the breaks. What makes this cover so awesome is that Doom is the largest figure on the page, with the four pipsqueaks who've been unconstitutionally attempting to ruin his plans for decades. They are little itsy-bitsy teeny-tiny figures. This juxtaposition of real estate on the cover, occupied by Dr. Doom, compared to Johnny, Ben, the beautiful Susan, and Mr. Stretchy McStupidface, is not just awesome, but it's awesome. The story, The Son of Dr. Doom, is sadly not about me. I mean, look, my dad's fine and all that, but... well, anyway, this one was written by the aforementioned Marv Wolfman and drawn and inked by the aforementioned Keith Pollard and Joe Sinnott. We start with Doom, victorious. He has trapped the failed four in transference globes and is beaming their power into the body of Victor Von Doom II, who Doom calls his son. As the machine operates, Doom plays a bombastic little symphony on his keyboard, something Wagnerian, I assume. And muses about his son's upcoming coronation. This glorious note is where the Latverian edition of this trade paperback ends. So we moved into the part of the story now that I'm unfamiliar with, the validity of which is questioned by many comic book historians. Nonetheless, in this version, in this apocryphal tale, Doom's thoughts are interrupted by Hauptmann, with news of a peasant rebellion led by Zorba. Doom appears on a balcony, overlooking the courtyard to address the crowd. As he launches into his harangue, carefully considered address, Zorba shouts that Doom does not intend to relinquish power at all, but will continue to rule through his son. This is where Doom opens fire at the crowd with blasts emanating from his fingers, simply to make a minor point about who's actually in charge here anyway. Zorba and his men stand their ground, taking aim with weapons they've smuggled into the country like the yellow-bellied villains they are. Doom asks his people to forgive his moment of anger. Tonight, when the coronation ceremony takes place, he says, he shall wield power no longer and will be content to garden away his remaining years. He leaves Hauptmann in charge of the power transference machine, and heads for Alicia Masters' chamber, or as this poorly translated book would have you believe, a dungeon. I think art studio would be the correct term, actually, as Alicia is working on a statue of the great man. She does question the validity of his promise to release her in the FF once the statue is completed, and he declares that he does not lie. The statue must be finished tonight, he adds, for it is to be presented to the United Nations when his son takes control of Latveria. It's important that the gift be given before the UN votes on a forced Latveria exit? Alicia comments on Doom wanting his face sculpted without its scars, and also about the hollowness of the statue's body. Well, Doom wants the world to think of him as pure, faultless, as the land and people of Latveria are. Hauptmann proves his stunning incompetence by allowing Mr. Stretchy Butt to break free, and he swiftly releases his three teammates. Doom's son is still a little loopy from the machine's treatment, and we learn Reed has attached a microfeedback system to short-circuit Doom's devices, which sounds pretty evil mad scientist to me. Reed warns that Doom is certain to have left his passageway guarded, but Ben promises to clobber whatever guards they may encounter. Ben shakes off the iconic force displacer blast before tearing up the floor and destroying all the servo guards, which, by the way, are Latverian property, so there are going to be some tickets and maybe even some fines involved. As the FF enters Alicia's studio, Doom takes her into protective custody. Should the Fantastic Four attack, the rest of his servo units will, well, destroy her, which I know that sounds really bad. At the coronation ceremony, his son beside him, Doom explains to his people that he always considered their welfare above his own, clarifying that it's for their own protection that he does not permit them to stray beyond Latveria's borders. What caring leader would? The world has considered him a despot for too long, so he will turn over the reign of Latveria to one few even knew existed, his son. Zorba sneaks inside the castle and releases the failed four. He hands Reed a sheet of paper he discovered in the castle, which Reed says explains everything, and that Doom must be stopped at all costs, because that's all he ever thinks about. Doom must be stopped at all costs. In full view of UN cameras, Doom places the crown of Latveria on the head of Victor Von Doom II. Suddenly, Zorba runs up, shouting that the man is not Doom's son, but is his clone. Realizing that this perfectly logical succession plan has been exposed, Doom tells the clone that it is now his turn. At this, the clone morphs into a muscular creature halfway between a normal man and a big, ugly rock monster. Doom is outraged that his clone's face has become almost as grotesque as his own. He orders him to destroy the Fantastic Four, but instead the clone slams Doom defiantly into a pillar. Doom created him in his own image a year ago and raised him in total secrecy, but he made a drastic mistake. Doom II reveals that he doesn't just have the FF's powers, but also their misguided opinions. Doom fends off the clone's attack with blasters, but the clone erects an invisible force field, not quite as strong as the one that Invisible Girl can make, to protect himself. Then he grabs Doom and weakly flames on, but Doom shoves him aside with force shields. The clone turns invisible and batters Doom, saying that because he possesses all of Doom's knowledge, as well as much of the Fantastic Four's powers, he has become Doom's most dreaded foe. Reed psycho babbles some stuff about the battle between Doom and his clone being like a battle between the two sides of Doom's psyche, and that in creating another human being, Doom has lost his own humanity. The clone insists that Doom must admit his self-hatred or lose whatever humanity remains in him. Unable to bear his clone's lies, 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 Doom sends a powerful shock through the clone's body. As the Fantastic Four looks at the charred corpse of Victor II, Doom asks why the clone made him kill him. Why did you torment me? Why? 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 The end. Good selection, Dr. Ange. Very good. In terms of being an issue of FF, which I try to avoid, this has one characteristic that I personally look for, and that is a major downplaying of the appearances of the actual members of that Dread team. When an issue of FF has too much FF, and by that I mean more FF than Dr. Doom, that issue falls pretty low in my estimation. You just wonder if Marvel had simply decreased the presence of the FF in the FF, this title may not have been canceled. Oh, sorry. I can't say that without smiling. Now, you may not know this, but the day that the last issue of FF hit the stands in 2015 was a week-long national celebration in Latveria. In every new comic book day until a new issue of the Fantastic Four appears is a national holiday. That is correct. Every worker has every Wednesday off with pay. And yes, that national midweek shutdown has slowed GDP growth in the country a bit. But as President Victor I regularly mentions, that is a sacrifice that all Latverians are willing, eager to make to keep new FF issues out of our comic book stores. Obviously, President Von Doom's role behind the scenes in the film business have pretty much made sure that no FF movie will be made for quite a number of years. And now here we are at the end of 2017, and we can look back and say, yes, it's taken, what, 55 years? But give Doom credit. The FF is dead, and he survives. Around these parts, we call that a victory. The details of this story, the clone, the statue, the UN, all of that was fine. Enjoyable, as a matter of fact. Mr. Marv Wolfman had the Doom attitude down pretty well. The dialogue was strong. The relationship between Doom and his loyal subjects, the dastardly turncoat traitors in his midst, all of that worked. And as we discuss in strategic management classes, it's just responsible for a leader to have a succession plan in place. So that definitely rang true and showed Doom's wisdom. Again, Marv Wolfman, good job on the writing of this one. And Dr. Ange, good job on selecting this one and having Mr. Wolfman sign it. Appreciate that, Doc. As always, there are other non-Doom books that I read last month, and I do have a responsibility to talk about more of those on this episode, so look, I gotta play a promo here, and when we come back, we'll talk about the trades, miniseries, long runs, and graphic novels that I read in November.
Warlord Worlds, a fan podcast devoted to the comic creations of Mike Grell, including Warlord, John Sable, Starslayer, Shaman's Tears, and Green Arrow. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. I hope you'll join us as we discuss the stories, characters, and art in the many excellent comics from writer and artist Mike Grell.
Warlord Worlds is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Find us at warlordworlds.com.
And we're back. And it's on to the trades, graphic novels, miniseries, and long runs that I read. And theme books as well. Because when I get the chance, I like to read thematically, based usually on the calendar. So for this month, I read a bunch of war comics, an observation of Veterans Day. And as it just sort of shook out, lots of these were Captain America books. The first two are sort of a podcast follow-up, because in addition to the one I read for the Veterans Day episode of Relatively Geeky Presents, when I talked with Scott Gardner about it, I also read two more of the Cap Theater of War books, Captain America, Theater of War, America First, and Captain America, Theater of War, America the Beautiful. This was a series from 2009, seven oversized, mostly standalone issues, designed to celebrate the history of Cap. America First was written and drawn by Howard Chaykin, takes place in the 1950s. At the height of the Red Scare, this takes on some of those issues and has a very surprising twist for the Joe McCarthy analog. America the Beautiful was one of the many issues in this series written by Paul Jenkins, and this one is a total heartbreaker or tearjerker. It starts in WW2 with Cap leading a mission in Italy with a squad that includes a cowardly soldier, who you sort of wonder how he hasn't washed out of the service at this point. Cap talks him up, tells him that he believes in the soldier, and gives him a task. Things go sideways, and it takes 70 years, but Cap keeps a promise that he made to that soldier. The three of these seven special Cap issues that I read were all quite different, but were also all quite good in different ways. And sticking with the theme of Cap, a bunch of issues from the Mark Grunwald run recently showed up in the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics, and I grabbed a bunch. So I read Captain America 334 through 338. These feature the John Walker version of Cap after Steve has been stripped of his shield and uniform by the government. In these stories, Steve is out west and eventually takes up the name The Captain, teaming up with Falcon, Nomad, and D-Man. No, seriously, D-Man. To do some vigilantizing, which Steve is quite ambivalent about. I like that he's so used to operating under the color of authority that he's a bit lost being outside of a command structure. That character bit was probably the best part of these issues. Walker and his buddy Lamar are working on operating as the new Cap and Bucky. They are sincere in their desire to fill those shoes, but recognize that that's not going to be easy. The next couple of issues were big event tie-ins, so I skipped those, but then I picked up the series with Captain America 342 to 345. A lot of Serpent Society stuff going on here, including an issue that must have had every snake-themed character in the Marvel U. Sidewinder, Slither, Coppermouth, Diamondback, Viper, Rattler, even Puff Adder. Puff Adder, are you kidding me? It was a fun read, and then the storyline included President Reagan being turned into a snake. Very subtle commentary there, Mr. Grunwald. Subtle. Overall, I found these a little overwritten, but with a lot of ideas, and most of those ideas pretty good. And then I jumped ahead a few decades and read some books that Jason Marcinette from the Heroes and Hops podcast and YouTube channel sent a while back. All new Captain America 1 through 6. This is the 2015 series by Rick Remender and Stuart Immonen, set just before that year's version of Secret Wars, and it tells the story of Sam Wilson's early days Cap, after Steve Rogers had the super soldier serum drained from him, aging him. Now he gets to hang out with Peggy Carter, and that's not such a bad old age. There's a lot going on in this series, including Steve's adopted son from another dimension, who fights with Sam as Nomad. They go up against Hydra, who's captured a young inhuman boy whose blood can sterilize anyone who touches it, and only Hydra has the antidote. So we have a blood bomb, and the vampire Baron Blood gets involved, and Misty Knight even shows up. So say what you will about modern comics and decompression, these six issues had a heck of a lot going on in them. and I think it was actually pretty good. And of all the non-Steve Rogerses who've taken up the Cap mantle, Sam Wilson is probably the one that deserves it the most. And in this series, he kind of gets it done. And like I said, I did read a few non-Cap books as well in observation of Veterans Day, including The Fightin' Five, number 45, a Charlton book from 1982, though it was reprinting material from 1965. This team is a lower-rent version of the Howling Commandos, but with nobody as compelling as Sergeant Fury. There was a coup in Southeast Asia, but the guy taking over wasn't really the guy taking over because he was a master of disguise. It was an okay story, and I thank the great Kanzen Greg Arujo for sending it my way. But there are times with other Charlton books and some of the other smaller publishers that you see completely what it is they are copying. I mean, being inspired by, and you see how they fell short so often of that original inspiration. The main thing I took from this issue was what a good job Stan and Jack did in creating and writing those early Nick Fury and the Howling Commando stories. And we'll talk about one of those shortly. Our Fighting Forces, 145. About halfway through this one, I realized that I'd read it before, a couple of years back. I was trying to place it and figured out that it was the month of the very first episode of this podcast. And I picked it up from the same place, and it may have well been the exact same copy. I really need to work on my database, because I wasted nearly 10 minutes rereading this for crying out loud. It actually wasn't a bad story. It was the losers fighting in North Africa circa World War II. And Fightin' Army, 167, another Charlton reprint book, again sent to me by the great Kanzen Greg Arujo. This was published in 83, but again, the stories were from the mid to late 60s. It's a really good World War II story from Germany about soldiers who fake their deaths to get behind the Germans. To use the language of the issue, get behind the Krauts, and launch a surprise attack. There was another one that may have been a weird war story, at least had that vibe to it, but it's subtle enough that I really wasn't sure. But the memorable part of this issue, the part that will stick with me, is the strange confluence of the full-page advertisements. In this issue, you had the option of spending $3 to make someone love you, or if that's a little too specific, for the slightly higher price of $12.95, which, by the way, does include postage, you could learn to make others secretly do your bidding with the astonishing power of authentic mind control. But for the just a little bit lower price of $10, you can come pretty close to that with the knowledge of how to read anyone's mind. Just not sure what that says about the demographics of Charlton readers, but I don't think it's good. But I have to say, it did make the comic, which was pretty good already, that much more fascinating. And here we are, Sergeant Fury 114. I'd mentioned the Stan and Jack era of this book, but this is way beyond that. This is a 73 issue written by Gary Frederick and was, again, pretty good. We start with a funeral for Nick Fury, and it's not a hoax, not a setup. Everyone believes he is legitimately dead. Spoilers, he's not. But this gives us a couple of pages at the start of the issue for all of the Howlers to reflect on Fury before the shocking reveal that he is in fact alive. The Howlers set out on a mission of vengeance, but it turns into a rescue mission, and of course, Fury himself aids in that rescue. This also touches on the fact that Fury had been psychologically tortured and is going through a little shell shock, they would have called it then, what we'd call PTSD today at the end of the story. And that's a nice touch. Again, good story, really well told. Over the last handful of years, I've become more of a fan of Black Hawk than ever before, and I picked up two comics at the Akron Comic-Con from the mighty quarter bins there. The retailer who had those quarter bins may have been Comic Heaven, but I think it was Fearless Readers. Nonetheless, among those awesome bargains I got were Blackhawk 261 from the Evanier and Spiegel run from 1983. This was a good one with the team on the trail of a Nazi Black Widow killer who has been killing Allied generals and stealing codebooks. Can Blackhawk lead his team to kill the woman? A woman from his own past? Dramatic, interesting, subtle, and adventurous. Good issue. And DC Comics Presents, number 69, featuring Superman and Blackhawk. It's a time travel story where Clark goes back to WW2 to solve a mystery from very early in Perry White's career. Perry's following the Blackhawk team, trying to get a front page worthy scoop of a story. And then Clark meets Albert Einstein, and then things get a little wacky. Fun read, and for a more detailed look at that book, check out episode 69 of Russell Bragg's DC Comics Presents Show. And don't worry, I have plenty more war books for next year. I've long been a fan of steampunk aesthetic, but it had been a while since I had read a steampunky comic. I just read some steampunk novels by J. Scott Savage, and that got me in the mood. So when I saw on the Hoopla app the trade collections of Lantern City 1 through 12, I borrowed it. In a totalitarian high-walled city, Lantern City, the Gray family rules supreme, using their brutal guards to keep the lower classes in line. A lower caste activist convinces his brother-in-law Sander to infiltrate the guards when they get a surprising opportunity to do so. He hopes to make a difference for his family and his caste, but he has a long road ahead of him. For someone who spent a lifetime trying to avoid the guard, becoming a member is a very difficult task. And as a guard, circumstances conspire that he ends up saving the life of a man in disguise who turns out to be the evil dictator of Lantern City. The dictator takes Sander under his wing, and that is when things get complicated. Really interesting story, and it actually manages to end the series, end the story, in a really satisfying way. Gave us a solid denouement as well, and that is not always easy. Again, the story's quite good and the character's interesting, but the key to a steampunk comic is the art and design elements. And again, they're very good. The airships look good. The guard uniforms are cool. And the evil gray tower is both foreboding and beautiful. Lots of curves and arcs and gaslight and brass. Good job on that. This was put out by Archaea Press, written by Matthew Daly and Margaret Scott, with art by Carlos Magno. It lists three other creators or co-creators, including Bruce Boxleitner. So I imagine that this was a TV pitch before it was turned into a comic. But however all that happened and however we ended up with this comic, overall, it was very, very solid. I guess I could have put this next one in the podcast-related category as I got the idea of reading this title after it was talked about on episode 8 of a pretty new podcast, The Collected Edition. So this month, via, again, the Hoopla app, I read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Issues 1 through 4. This is a 24-issue series, illustrated by Tony Parker. I only mention the artist here because the comic series contains the full text of the Philip K. Dick novella. Now that means it's wordy, and that in a lot of ways the words take over for the pictures. And when I say that every word in the novella is in this book, I mean every word, including he said and she said, that sort of thing. So literally, nothing is cut, which means it's only sort of an adaptation. Now, for me, a comic book is usually story first, art second. And when that comic book contains the full text of an existing work, it's even more so words first, art second. But I gotta be honest, this was a really weird reading experience. Now, I have read the novella before, but it's been a number of years. And the images of Blade Runner are much more fresh in my memory. So in that sense, it was nice to get back into the original story with the broader focus, more characters. And because the movie does take enough liberties with the original story, there is potential for some freshness in this version of it. In these four issues, what we're really getting at is just the world and Decker's job of tracking down the missing six super androids and the importance of empathy and the empathy test in that mission. I think I'm going to keep reading it. We mentioned Iowa's Joe Crawford's recent care packages before. He also sent Spider-Woman 5 and 7. This is from the Dennis Hopeless run from 2015. Jessica Drew from after she left the Avengers. In these two issues, Jessica teams up with Ben Urich to investigate the disappearances of various family members of small-time villains. It turns out that they're being protected in exchange for the villains working for the big bad. In these two issues, I don't know who the big bad was, but that seemed to be the reveal at the end of issue 7. Interesting idea, and the art by Javier Rodriguez and Alvaro Lopez gave this a light, fun, bouncy feel. Before this, I knew Jessica Drew mostly from the iOS game Spider-Man Unlimited, but this educated me about her, and I found these issues very enjoyable. And more of my Hoopla Archie finds were Archie 75th Anniversary Digest 4 and 5. I've talked about this series over the last few episodes that it came out last year in that 75th anniversary year for Archie. And yes, I'm reading the digital version, but I don't think these were digital only, like some of Archie's digital offerings are. Now, each of these digests has had a bit of a different focus to it, but I'm glad I read these two together, 4 and 5, because they were both heavily Betty and Veronica themed. And there were stories from the 1940s up through the 2000s, showing the changing circumstances of their relationship, to say nothing of their character models. I always enjoy the range of stories in these collections. For me, that's the key. I mentioned that in terms of Life with Archie and Laugh earlier in the episode. Now here, for example, there was a full-length 22-pager with B&V basically being Charlie's Angels. We also saw the change in their dynamics when Cheryl Blossom arrived in Riverdale, and then also when Ginger shows up. Then there was the story when circumstances led Betty to date Reggie. That was one nobody expected, especially them. They also threw in some Katie Keene issues in here as well, and those were interesting reads. Total changes of pace, and as changes of pace, those stories worked. Again, pretty enjoyable digest collections. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, Dial H is always fun. Some of the war books were good, especially that Sergeant Fury and the Blackhawk. All New Cap was solid. And the failed four, number 199, signed by the Marv Wolfman, that's a strong candidate for best read of the month, as is that Mickey Mouse Secret Agent issue. But the title that stands out for me is that steampunk sci-fi story, Lantern City. In terms of single best issue, I'm going to go with the one that I think marked the end of Act 2, moving into Act 3. Which would be Lantern City number 10. Next month, December, is a 5-Saturday month, and the semester ends halfway through, so I imagine I'm going to read a lot of comics, and that it's going to be a super long episode. I have cleared this with the higher-ups in Latveria, and I am going to drop the Doom segment in December to make up for these other special features, because the December episode always includes a countdown of my favorite reads of the year, as well as the awarding of the coveted, relatively geeky, Listener of the Year award. So like I said, that's probably going to be a long one. And we'll hear all about that when that episode comes out, which should be sometime around New Year's Eve. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I've mentioned, and you can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.